Hi, this is Candace Michelle, and welcome back to another segment of Our Community. You know, the past 18 months or so has been a constant barrage of challenges, hardships, frustrations, and overwhelming loss. All of us have been touched personally by this pandemic in some way. For some, our whole way of life has changed. For others, their lives were cut short, and they died often alone. It's been pretty bleak. But every once in a while, in the midst of all the loss, there's been a win. And that's something to celebrate. Joining me today, as always, is Brookings Core Response Executive Director, Diana Cooper, and Community Health Worker at Core Response, Michelle Carroll. Welcome to the show, my friends. So nice to see your faces.
I know everybody else can't see us, but hi.
I know, but I can see your face. I know. So I remember, I think it was the first Zoom meeting, way back in April of 2020, wasn't it? With Jake and the two of you. It in April?
It was, I think it was May, because it was about a month later when we actually met in person.
Okay.
So, okay. We met in person in July, but I think it was back in May, 2020.
Okay. And Jake was just, you know, trying to get people together who cared about the unsheltered people in our community. And I think it was you, Michelle, and Diana, and Jake, and me. Was there anybody else on that one?
There was one more person.
Yeah. Was it Candy? Might have been Candy.
Yes, that's who it was, Candy Berry.
Interesting, right? Doesn't that seem like forever ago?
It does. Weird, yeah.
I mean, it's seriously, you know, it just so much has happened since then. It's like...
Yeah, it feels like we've known each other for years.
I know, it does. I know. It's kind of funny, but, you know. So wasn't that sort of the beginning of Core Response?
It was the beginning of the original beginning of the idea was years ago, but this was Michelle and I's first time to I wasn't going to do anything with that idea. So this was the first time where we actually brought that together and we were like, hey, we should do something.
And now you two didn't know each other, did you?
No. No, I didn't know her before that meeting with Jake, yeah.
Right? I mean, that's...
Just saw each other on Jake's chat. That's how we came to know
her. It's amazing when you think about it. You know, it's just the weaving of the circle. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's kind of amazing. So, we know a lot about Diana at this point because Diana likes to talk.
What?
And she's been talking for weeks and weeks now. But we don't know a lot about you, Michelle. So, you know, you wanna tell us about who Michelle is?
Yeah. I came to Brookings in 2000 from Bakersfield, California.
Ooh, that's hot down there. Yeah.
It is very hot. So it was a big change. I came here with my kids. Mm-hmm. And so I've been here for a long time.
21 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
you've seen a lot of changes, I would think.
Yes. Yeah, and this definitely feels like home to me. And I'm raising my grandson now, so I'm kind of starting all over in the kid thing.
You've got more guts than I do.
And he's 8 now, so...
Well, that's actually a wonderful...
He takes up a lot of my
time. That's a wonderful age, though, right? Because they're thinking on their own, and they're reasoning, and... Yeah, it's a magical age.
Their reasoning and their unreasoning.
Well, yes.
They're
unreasonable, right? Yeah. Sometimes, yes.
He's a pretty great kid, though.
That's excellent. So you are basically his parent at this point, right?
Yeah, I've had him since he was a baby, so I'm pretty much mom. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in addition to being mom, you also work a lot, right?
A lot, yes. 6 days a week is what I'm doing right now.
And some of it is volunteer, right? I mean, you know, most of it's paid, but some of it's volunteer.
Not at this point. We're finally.
You're actually getting paid for everything you do?
Mm-hmm. We're actually getting paid now.
That's so amazing.
Michelle came on payroll at the church in January, but we still, neither of us were making full-time. We were still making part-time until last month. In fact, this was the first full paycheck we've had.
So. Wow. Excellent. Excellent.
Pretty nice.
So that's a good thing.
And so you're both working out of St. Tim's and, you know, basically, Michelle, you're doing a lot of boots on the ground kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. We do St. Tim's and Monday, Wednesday, Friday mornings, and then we work in the clinic in the afternoons of those days. And I work Saturday in the clinic. And then Tuesday, Thursday, I'm just doing outreach on those days out in the community.
So you are a community health worker. What does that mean to you? What does that involve?
Well, I guess I've always known I wanted to help people. But like in my mind, that maybe meant going overseas to help, you know, starving children or something. But, you know, that's not what helping people has to be. You know, I never knew what a community health worker was until last year. So I guess I had blinders on, like so many people, to, you know, the suffering in my own community. So or to my ability to help some of that. So being a community health worker, you know, provides that opportunity to help people in my own community.
Mm-hmm. I think it's true that we see what we expect to see, you know, that if our worldview is about just our regular lives, that's what we see. We tend to not see the other things. Like if somebody said to you, you know, look around the room and memorize everything that's red and then close your eyes and now tell me everything you saw that was blue, we wouldn't notice those blue things because we were concentrating on the red. So, and I think that's often the way it is with people who are marginalized. We don't actually see them. You know,
well, we see them kind of look right past what they are right now, you know, like what they are in front of us, but we don't see their potential sometimes. And even Michelle and I are at fault of that, even in the work we're doing sometimes, but we recognize that that's not our call. And so we're just there to support. But, you know, clearly, even recently with our friend Michael, we've seen the potential, you know, at the end. We saw, I think there was a picture that was sent out. I know we're probably going to talk about Michael. But
yes, we're definitely going to talk about Michael.
So, but when there was a picture sent, Michelle sent it to me the other night, like night before last, and I had no idea who it was. I did not know. I genuinely thought, is this somebody that we should be on the lookout for?
Right.
And she said that that's Michael. And it's a weird moment when you see someone at the end of the, even though it was only a week, the end of that transformation, you're kind of like, oh, that's the person I was, that this is the person I was waiting for. This is the person we were helping. And, you know, the person in the pictures from before, that's a part of who he was, but that's not who he was. And so we got to see a picture of who we actually were helping. And
that is nice. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah,
because a lot of times we can't see past that whole outward appearance either, you know, the hair and the dirt
and
all of that stuff. It's hard to see past that. It is.
It's like it's like doing a painting or something, you know, and not to say that Michael is our work of art. Clearly, I give all credit to God, but it's like doing a painting and then, you know, it just looks funky for a while. But at the end, you don't even necessarily know how that was going to look. And it's interesting to be on the other end of that.
The unsheltered community members have a rough time, even in the best circumstances. But in a pandemic, the few resources that have been available here were either closed, like the DMV, or overwhelmed and understaffed. So that must have been rough. And especially then to have your efforts to meet those needs being met by bureaucratic red tape, apathy, hostility, by the very people who are in a position to actually do something to help. How do you keep going? I mean, that would be,
well, Michelle can probably answer. Michelle can probably answer some of the, especially the DMV stuff. She's been doing a lot of that lately.
Yeah. How do you do that? How do you do it?
I mean, it's gotten a lot better recently. The DMV staff knows me by name now.
Michelle.
I'm in there a few times a week.
Just going to set up a desk.
Yes, they do.
Oh, that's great.
I think we can co-locate with the DMV.
Yeah, maybe.
Make it a lot easier, right?
Oh, gosh. Yes.
But, you know, several months ago, it wasn't the case because you couldn't just walk in. You know, I have my set time that I go that makes it the easiest for me now, but... You know, back then, you couldn't do that. You know, you had to go online and you had to try and find an appointment time. And then it was 2 to 3 months before you could get in. And it was really difficult. And without an ID, you know, people have a very difficult time doing anything else. So now, you know, we're getting people IDs often. And then those same people are getting jobs. We've recently helped people get jobs, several times. And it's so nice to see.
And it's so frustrating when folks don't understand that the missing component is that first step of having identification. If you don't have that, you can't go down the road. You know, you just can't. I mean, it's bad enough that, you know, if you don't have a place to live, that you're, you know, sleeping in your car or, you know, whatever, and trying to somehow clean up and go to work and all of that. But you can't even get the job if you don't have identification.
No,
you can't. Yeah, and it's not, and same with housing. You can't get housing, you know, without that piece. And so, if you don't have it, a lot of times they're not going to hold the job or hold the house for you. And so it really is. Having an ID sometimes is a matter of getting that opportunity or just not getting that opportunity. So it's not as easy as just going out and getting a job or getting a place or anything. There's a lot of barriers, and that first one is ID.
Yep. Yep.
And that's where we start often. So
when the DMV was not open, now it's open and you can actually make an appointment, right? So when before it was open, you had to do everything online. That must have been like trying to coordinate having your clients sitting there with you during the time that there was the appointment. I mean, it's mind-boggling to think about how you would have to coordinate all of that.
And they missed a lot of them. I don't know how many you, Michelle, but back before we could do, so we don't even have to do appointments with the DMV now. We just walk in. Mm-hmm. But back then, not just having to do appointments, but having to do them so far out and having to do them online, and some you could navigate online and some you couldn't. Some people just didn't show up for their, you know, it'd be 2 months out, and by the time we got to it, we hadn't seen them in a couple of weeks. We couldn't remind them. And then they just didn't show. And, you know, life happens. So the walk-in is always the best way to go. I'm really glad that we can do that again.
Yeah, I'm glad that you can too. I can't imagine the frustration of trying to get those things in place in the middle of a pandemic. I mean, you know, it's hard enough, right? It's hard enough. I mean, me going online, trying to navigate the state of Oregon, you know, it's like, wow, right?
And there's still other things that are still difficult, like Social Security. Yeah. You know, we still can't go into a Social Security office. So, you know, Social Security cards are very hard to replace. because you have to send in the actual documents. You have to send in your ID, and then they send it back to you.
Yeah.
So the ID actually has to leave your hand?
Yes.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Although if you have an interim card, you can send the interim card. So, you know, if somebody was to get their ID and they got the interim and then their plastic one was mailed to them, when they got the plastic one, they could technically send in the interim.
If they still have it.
Yes, if they still have it, but it's paper and paper's not hard to, or it's not easy to keep outdoors. So
No. And as we go into the rainy season, it's going to be
gonna
be even harder. Yeah.
There will be a lot of people when we emerge next spring that are going to need a lot of replacement documentation. It's just like that over here.
Yeah. Yes,
it's not the same in some other places, but that's one of the barriers we face here. And we have to recognize that's not necessarily the fault of the people we're working with. It has a lot to do with our area.
I don't know how you could call it the fault of the people that you're working with at all. I mean,
well, I don't
know. They're trying to maintain a life when they're outside.
Right, right.
That's and of course, I mean, if you lay your stuff down by the side of a river.
Sometimes we do stupid things just because we're not thinking. And
right.
You know,
right.
And then one guy one time, and this was not his fault at all, his pack, the tide came in and his pack got carried out to the ocean.
Oh,
so, you know, totally not his fault.
No.
So it just happens here.
Yeah. Mm. So there have been some losses in this past 18 months. And there have been some near misses. And I'm thinking about Bill Buchanan, for one. I mean, that was a loss that didn't have to happen. That happened because the safety nets that we thought were in place or would hold just either weren't there or didn't hold. It was appalling. And I'm sure that there have been others like that.
Yeah, Bill was a big one, you know, that hit me really hard. You know, I still remember when we heard about it, you know, we were in the middle of helping Jennifer, you know, who was in the tent over at the park at the time. And when Bernie sent me a text and told me that he had found, you know, his shipping container, and I just lost it, you know, I broke down in tears. And I think we had all expected to find him deceased at some point, but not in a horrific way like that.
Yeah. I mean, I had just maybe a week before that, I had sent a message. I was working with, you know, his insurance company, with the ombudsman from the state, with a state representative through Adult Protective Services, and we were all kind of communicating on the back end. And I had just sent an email maybe a week before that to them stating, you know, my concern is that one of the community health workers or someone's going to go up there and to check in on him, and they're going to find him dead. And, you know, thankfully it was Bernie and not one of us or one of the other people that we had at the time. But, you know, it was still pretty horrific, even just knowing what had happened. And you know, we thought he was maybe going to pass from his disease or something. But, you know, fire is a pretty rough way to go. And so, yeah, that one did hit us pretty hard. And we were right in the middle. I mean, we were gloving up and getting ready to, you know, get Jennifer up and take care of her at that time. And so it just sort of felt like a double blow because, you know, we couldn't stop to take it in. We had to keep moving, and it just really sucked. Yeah.
And Bill is not the only person who's died in the last. I mean, there were several deaths, as I recall, Diana, that you said something about. There were like 10 deaths in the last however many months, which was a higher number than usual, right?
Much higher. I think it was, let me think. There was about 6 months period of time where we lost 8 or 9 people, and then a couple more shortly after. So, Yeah, that was a much, you know, a much higher loss than I think we've ever had here for people who are unsheltered. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know that there were environmental factors that contributed to their death and health issues and things like that. So well, I think there's a, Michelle and I went over to, oh, wait, you didn't go with us, Michelle, but yesterday I went with Riley and the kids and Deacon Linda over to the garden area. And there's a bench there that has plaques on it that are dedicated to the folks that we've lost over the last year that were living outside. Nice. Yeah, it was very nice. Yeah. So I think there's a couple more that are still going to go on there. But I saw, you know, Larry's name, and he passed away from cancer. But we were able to get him in a motel at the end there so that he wasn't, you know, passing in his truck. And then Forrest, who, you know, was hit by a truck right after he got back to Brookings. And then just some others, Terry and Dave and some other folks that we've, you know, we had gotten to know and were trying to assist with. So, but there was, you know, several names on the plaques and it was just kind of nice.
It must take an emotional toll for both of you, though, to work so hard to try to save them, you know, try to make a difference, try to keep them on the planet for a little bit longer.
I think after each one, it's hard to not go to that place of, you know, could I have done any more, you know, to not, for it to not have happened or to not, you know, to prevent it, but you just can't go there, you know, or it would, you know, you'd be devastated. So. Yeah,
we have to, I mean, we talk about it often, especially after we process a lot of things after they happen with Bernie and sometimes just Michelle and I. But and then, of course, I mean, especially after what happened with Bill, we all kind of sought out some little more urgent mental health support for ourselves. And because that one was particularly rough.
It was. Shocking.
So
you know,
it really
kind of shocking, you know. Somehow I expected it to work out. I don't know what it was I expected to happen, but I somehow thought there was a safety net somewhere that somebody, right, would say, oh, no, that can't happen. Wait a second. Let me step in and help. And it just didn't happen.
Well, we kind of live in a space, not on purpose, but we live in a space of, you know, kind of some cognitive dissonance where we see the person on the side of the road, or we hear of a situation and we think if it was not their fault, it will work out. And that works two ways. For the people when it doesn't work out, we often think, clearly they did something wrong, because if it, you know, there are safety nets in place, there are things in place. So unless they do something wrong, they're going to get help. And that's obviously not the case. And, you know, in Bill's case, it was kind of, I think, a shock to a lot of people, because people knew Bill, you know, the community knew Bill.
Yes.
And so it wasn't the same as, you know, if Michael Brown had died out there, which we were worried, we were very worried, that was going to be the case. And if he had, people would have thought, well, that's just the way things are, because they didn't know him. They didn't know how hard he did try or how hard he couldn't try. They didn't know his story, but people knew Bill's story. And so when it didn't work out, I think people were genuinely confused about how that could have went that way. And we know, because we deal with that system every day, you know, we deal with, and it's not to say that these are horrible systems. It's just that we don't have the right safety net in place locally to let these systems do their job. You know, DHS could be very effective if we had enough resources, like a temporary shelter for people like Bill or like Mike, who, you know, eventually will get that resource in place that they're seeking out, but it's not quick. So,
don't have a lot of time, you know, then
which the fact we never
that
know.
It doesn't, and the fact that it doesn't happen quickly can, in fact, be the thing that kills them, that it doesn't happen quickly enough.
That's kind of what keeps us trying to move quickly. Mm-hmm. And I know mm-hmm. Michelle did a lot of the back end work for Michael. And, you know, it's frustrating because you hit a lot of dead ends and you have to just try to navigate around that and just stay on it. And it wears on you. I know, you know, Michelle, I don't know if you want to talk about that, but I know it wore on you to kind of have to, after every no, to turn around and try to find another solution. And
yeah, it does. It's, you know, mentally, emotionally exhausting sometimes because there are a lot of no's or letdowns. Mm-hmm. Towards the end, even we thought he was going to be going to an assisted living in Gold Beach, thought it was all in place, everything mm-hmm. was done, did all the work we were supposed to do. And then at the last minute, they said they couldn't take mm-hmm. him, you know, just because he had had a trach before. And so then had to start all over again.
Good Lord.
You know, and
mm-hmm. yeah, that's rough.
So luckily, you know, something was found for him, but
yeah,
it can be very frustrating.
In another area too, because there are a lot more resources in other areas. And so
right.
we're not restricting ourselves to just Curry County for sure. So sometimes, and it feels like a lot of the time, that's where we make a breakthrough is when we start reaching outside of the area. So
I remember Jennifer, and you've both mentioned her. She was a disabled woman that was in a wheelchair, as from my memory, and basically living in a tent. And she was in Azalea Park for a while, and then I think she got moved over to St. Timothy's. I think mm-hmm. the cops moved her or something. And she was a near miss. I mean, she could have, I think if she had spent any more time in that tent, that she wouldn't have made it. And
I think that she was pretty hardy. She had a pretty hardy attitude about things. And I know she often kind of broke down, but she really was a pretty tough woman. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, when you're outside, especially if you're in a position like she was where you can't move, you can't get up or roll over, or at least not easily, mm-hmm. you know, you're kind of subject to having issues with your joints, which she already had some issues, and then getting bed sores and stuff like that. So, and of course, especially if you don't have access to a restroom, getting a UTI and other, you know, urinary tract infections and things like that.
It's amazing to me that people don't think about that stuff, right? I mean, that, you know, the people who are all annoyed because there's somebody living in a tent, you know, in the parking lot. It's like, really, can you not for a moment mm-hmm. just imagine yourself in that tent? Imagine yourself in her shoes and what that must feel like, what that must be like, and how incredibly difficult it is.
Well,
is there no empathy?
That's the space where people think we all were given the same, you know, we were all afforded the same resources and all of the same things in life. And even if there's a difference, which people will admit, it's not so much so that you ended up in a tent and I didn't because of just life. It has to be your decisions. It has to be something wrong with you that caused you to be where you're at. And that's not true on any level. I'm not, mm-mm. you know, we all do have self-determination, but that's not the only thing that plays into our life. So again, there's the cognitive dissonance where, you know, they do see that. I'm sure if they really sat down and thought about it, if you asked them, well, don't you care that they don't have a restroom facility? They'll say, and you know, the collective, they being right. all the naysayers, you know, right. they'll say that, well, sure, of course, but if they wanted to do something about it, they could. So they don't grasp the concept that...
Because that's insane, yeah. okay?
Yeah.
What could they do about it?
Right? I mean, especially right now, there's...
Yeah.
It's very... If it's difficult for Michelle and I to to navigate a lot of this. Imagine, you know, how it must be for others who don't can't go home at night and like get a good rest. Not that we always get a good rest, but
but it's true. You know, I've just recently been trying to navigate the health care system for my husband, right? Mm-hmm. Who's, you know, maybe looking at knee surgery, and there's a bunch of stuff that has to happen before that, including an echocardiogram and, you know, a referral to a cardiologist and all of this stuff, right? And I feel like I'm drowning. Like, I don't know how to navigate this system. And you talk to one person, then they tell you, oh, well, you need to go do this. And so you go do that. And then there's another person said, oh, no, that wasn't what you were supposed to do. You were supposed to do this. And,
right.
And it's like, whoa. And I consider myself a fairly intelligent and privileged person. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have telephones. I have computers. I know how to speak the language, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, it ain't easy, you know, it ain't easy. None of it is. And especially, right? Especially in a pandemic, for heaven's sake, you know, I mean, please.
And sometimes it's hard to relate that to people, just how many barriers there are. And I mean, you really have to get down there with them to actually see the full weight of what's happening for each person. Because, you know, if we were on a spectrum, I don't remember how many, what is there, 8 billion people in the world or something like that, or 8 point
something? I can never remember.
Yeah, it's like under 9 billion. So if there was a spectrum and, you know, of eight, we'll say 8.5 billion. If there's a spectrum of 8.5 billion dots, we're all slightly different. We're all going to be somewhere else on that. You know, nobody's going to be on the same dot. Yeah. And so it's kind of hard to understand, I guess, people from the other end of the spectrum. Like, you're too far away to see it. Right. And so I almost wish that, you know, in the same way that we, well, should listen to the experts in science, I wish that we would listen to the experts on the ground. You know, we do know what we're talking about when we say that it's not just as easy as getting up and getting a job and all of that. You know, we have people, they are trying. They're trying very hard. We see them every day. You know, there are some people who are not there yet. I wouldn't say that they don't want it. I would say that they're not at a place where they feel like they're capable. And we hope that someday that changes for them. But you know, there are a lot of people who are ready, and we sit down and work with them every day. And it's, sometimes it's just setback after setback. And I've heard this a lot lately. It's been so hard for people that they think, well, it can't be like this for everybody. And so they'll say things to us like, I just can't get any help, or I just can't, you know, nothing can go good for me right now. And we have to explain to them and remind them, not that this is very encouraging, but that it's not them. It's like that for everyone right now. And, you know, that we're just going to be there to try. We're not going to give up.
And you know, you say that's not encouraging, but I think it is on some level to know that it's not you. It's, don't internalize that, because it isn't you. It's the world right now. It's, you know, we're in the midst of a pandemic. The systems that we thought were in place are not. And there's trauma. I mean, there's just plain trauma that everybody's got, different trauma that's happened to them, that is still happening to them. You know, we just...
Yeah.
It's rough. It's rough. And I'm thrilled that you guys are on the ground doing what you're doing, because, you know, without you, there wouldn't be anybody on the ground doing it. So Michael was a win, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Michelle, tell us about Michael Brown. Who was Michael Brown? Who is Michael Brown? Where did he come from? Where was he? Where did you find him? Where did he find you?
Yeah. I first met him when I started working at St. Tim's a year ago. You know, back then he was walking fine and he would come in for services at St. Tim's. And I remember he always wanted a comb. That's the first thing I remembered about him is he always wanted a comb. But from what I've gathered, he came from California somewhere. And I know that he was in an accident, you know, in 79. And that's, you know, where his most of his physical problems have come from. But in the last six to eight months, I'd say I've seen a decline in his mental and physical, you know, health. So, you know, that's when he started having a lot of problems. And we really, but, you know, in that time, he never wanted four walls around him. So until the last few months when things got really bad for him, you know, then he agreed that, you know, he wanted to be inside and he needed help. And that's when the work began.
So why did he not want four walls? Do you have any sense of that? Was it that he didn't want to feel enclosed?
I don't know, or, you know. It could be, you know, just the mental part, the mental illness and the traumatic brain injury that he suffered.
I don't
know.
It's hard to tell sometimes.
He's been, he's been homeless for a very long time.
He wanted a boat. He wanted to be out on the ocean, you know. I don't think that his understanding of his capability was realistic. And not that we're, you know, obviously we encourage people to live to their highest potential, but physically.
But maybe he was, sailing out on the ocean was not part of that picture.
We told him that, you know, we said, well, I don't, you know, sailing maybe with another person with you or something, Mike, because you're a little bit less steady on your feet than you used to be. And, you know, he knew, but he just, for whatever reason, you know, whether it was the brain injury or whether it was some mental illness or, you know, maybe he just didn't want to deal with people. He just had an aversion to that. And yeah, it did change. I mean, we saw him. It was pretty clear when he started to decline. It was pretty obvious. You know, I'd be willing to bet a lot of people around town would have noticed had they paid attention, because a lot of people knew who Michael was. Not who he was, like, actually, but they knew of him. They'd seen him pushing a cart around or sort of walking near the bridge area or down in harbor. So, you know, it was pretty obvious to everybody when he started to decline, because he was not around. He wasn't walking around anywhere. He was just laying, mostly.
So he wasn't able to walk? He was basically immobilized?
He couldn't even get up by himself at the end. He couldn't move. He couldn't get up on the bench anymore. We had to, you know, literally pick him up.
Wow.
Or he laid on the ground all day.
And his legs were pretty, when we did get him ready, it was last Friday, so a week from yesterday, we got him, you know, into some new clothes and got him all ready so that he could make the trip over to Medford, which is where he's living now. And even his pants size was way, way smaller. You know, his waist was smaller. His legs were very small. And he'd very clearly lost quite a bit of weight. So I think
muscle
that he
wasn't mass,
able
probably,
to use.
If he wasn't walking, he was,
His legs were pretty small, even his thighs. And so I know he was having problems with his hip. I'm not sure if he fell and something happened, but they're definitely, you know, getting him checked out and taking care of him now. So maybe.
So you were seeing him like on a daily basis, weren't you, Michelle? I mean, you were.
As often as I could, you know, three or four times a week at least. So, but I would always look over and see, you know, how he was doing when I would drive by. And I still catch myself doing it now when I drive by and I forget, you know, that he's not there anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, even though he went through a lot and he suffered a lot, he always had a smile on his face every time I would see him.
Especially if you brought him coffee.
You know, that's he was a coffee addict for sure.
So people would bring him food. You'd bring him food.
Yes, that's the only way he would eat is if people brought him food.
Of course, because how else would he get it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did he have blankets or anything to, you know, kind of keep the chill off of him?
He did. He had a few sleeping bags, but you know, they would get wet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was just hard at the end because he couldn't get to a restroom. Mm-hmm. So it was hard to keep things dry for him.
Yep.
Yeah, that's when, I mean, we all assume someday when I'm older and I can't walk and I can't make my food and I can't get up and do things, like somebody will help me. And I mean, it's just, I don't understand the difference between somebody with housing and without housing. When they get to that point, there shouldn't be any difference. And when systems come in and say, okay, you know, we're ready, we should just have space. And I get it that that's sort of us trying to live in a perfect world here, but, you know, we just should. That's the same with babies. If I just decided today, like, well, my kids are older, they could probably fend for themselves. But, you know, if they're a baby, if I just said, well, I just don't want to be a parent, and I just left, like, nobody would leave my kid outside until they found space, you know?
Right.
And I don't know why we do that with our seniors. Do we think that they're not contributing? Have they not contributed their entire life? And even people with disabilities that contribute in different ways, I don't understand how that we don't see that as equally contributing to society. And does it matter? We're human, you know? So
I think that's an excellent point. I mean, you know, particularly when you're thinking about senior citizens who have, in fact, spent their lives contributing to the society in which they live and suddenly find themselves unable to take care of themselves, unable to...
We owe them as a society, just in the same way we owe our children a good upbringing. Yeah. We owe seniors and people with disabilities and people who cannot fully take care of themselves. We owe them the accommodations, in my opinion, that they should have to live a full, happy life like the rest of us. And the size and amount of our interpretation of their contribution to the world shouldn't matter.
No.
But here we are, you know.
I know. It seems insane to me. You know, it's like, do we really not value human lives? I mean,
we just don't understand our part in it is what it is, Candace. People do, I genuinely do think most people value human life. There are some people I think that actually have mental health disorders that, you know, they don't have empathy and things like that. But for the majority of the time, of course, we all value human life. We just don't understand what our part is and that we all do have a part. I mean, even voting. I know so many people who don't even vote. And, you know, I'm sure people have a lot of different opinions on that. But that's just, I mean, that's just the basic way we can help people and help make the world more equitable, because our individualism contributed to the whole will contribute to everybody's experiences. And, you know, I speak for myself and people who've had experiences like me. So if I decide not to speak, a lot of people don't get heard through that. And so I think it's incumbent upon all of us, especially those in a position where we're able to have a voice, to use that, whether it's to vote or to sit on committees or, you know, maybe you're doing direct work with people. I mean, that's my soapbox, so.
Well, I completely agree with you. I think we have an obligation. And admittedly, I grew up with JFK saying, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Mm-hmm. So that was how I grew up. And that made sense to me, was service. You know, you give as much as you can, where you can and when you can. You are of service to your community, to your world. Mm-hmm. And I don't really understand the mindset of my individual liberty is more important than the communal whole benefit. Mm-hmm. I don't understand that. But that wasn't the way I was raised. So, you know,
maybe
I don't know.
Maybe somehow we've kind of brought up some of our community to sort of come from a scarcity point of view, it seems like. So,
oh yeah. There's never enough, right? There's never enough.
And I'm glad
you got to get your share, right? You
got to
get your share, because if you don't get your share, then there won't be there. It's like,
But it's not like that. There's definitely enough to go around, and there's definitely enough people to contribute. I mean, we found that down at St. Tim's, that if we come at it from a different point of view, that, you know what, this will come back around later if we need it. You know, we seem to do pretty well with that. And, you know, thankfully, Bernie is of that same mindset and opinion. And we give, I like to think we give more than we get.
It always feels better to me to be giving. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I will receive if I have to, okay? But it feels better to give. It just feels better to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's looking at somebody's face when you give them something that they weren't expecting or, you know, didn't think was coming. It's like, it's magic. It's, you know, it's nice. Yeah. So I remember Father Bernie saying a couple of times, probably on Compline, that he thought that if Michael had had to spend one more night on the ground, that he might not have made it. And the night of the day that Michael left and mm-hmm. went to Medford was the night that it rained like 2 inches.
Mm-hmm. That was our first big rain.
Yeah, right? So it's very likely that Michael was not only a win, but a near miss again, right?
I don't know about you, Michelle, but the first thing that happened when the rain hit was I thought about, like, thank God, you know, thank God he's not out there.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. That was a heavy rain, and yeah, he would have froze.
Mm-hmm. It just
because he wasn't capable of doing anything to try and warm himself, even, you know, grab for the blanket that was 3 feet mm-hmm. away from him. You know, a lot of times he would just roll off the bench to the ground next to it. So, yeah, it would have been bad.
It seems to me, and, you know, call me Pollyanna, but it seems to me that a warming shelter is the very least we can do for mm-hmm. our community members who don't have a home. Why is this so hard? Why?
It would be a really, really wonderful safety net, because I don't think that people, like I said, you know, I don't think people quite understand how precarious it is in our community, because they're not at risk for that.
Right.
And for them, what happens behind the curtain, I mean, it could be anything. So, you know, when they, like I said, when they see someone who's out on the street, they don't know how they got there. They have to make some sort of assumption in their head about it. And so oftentimes with a warming shelter or something like that, a temporary shelter, a nightly shelter would be ideal, where, you know, it's where people can come by a certain time and get in and get a bed. And even something like that, where it's, you know, in conjunction with the county, where if people get out of jail or if they get out of the hospital and they don't have a space for the night, that even an officer could drop them off. You know, it's just a little bit of a step where on the back end, it would help us so much. And on the front end, nobody would even see. They would just see less people. I think unless they got involved, they wouldn't really understand the benefit. You'd have to really, I mean, you really have to show people what's happening behind the scenes for them to get a good grasp, just like anything. And so it would give us an avenue to kind of show them what's happening and how it's averting, it's averting people ending up on the streets that shouldn't be, like Michael and Jennifer.
And it's averting things like, you know, people clogging up the emergency rooms that don't have to be there. They're there because they're cold and wet and, you know.
Well, here we see a lot of people in the emergency room because they don't have primary care. We're still working on getting a lot of people set up with primary care. But also, we don't have an urgent care. And so that makes it a little bit difficult because there are some things that can't wait for your primary care appointment. And getting care for something like that, for a lot of our folks, getting care at the ER is not helpful. It can cause more damage than just not getting them the care or trying to care for it themselves, you know. And I mean, I think Michelle and I and probably everybody else would agree, you know, when we see a medical issue that's a little more urgent than a primary care appointment, our first instinct is to be like, well, you need to go to the ER. But then we have to stop and be like, well, but is that the best route?
And why would it not be? Like, do they not get the kind of care that they need? Or why would that not be?
I think when there's a one-size-fits-all approach to care, it doesn't work for people who are living on the street. Because some of the, you know, if I was living, you know, I have a house, so if I went to the emergency room and had a cut on my hand and it was really bad and you gave me some stuff and said, okay, you know, it doesn't look like it needs stitches or anything, but go home and keep it clean and keep it dressed.
Keep it clean, right?
That is not realistic. Yeah. And I get it that the emergency room, they can't like get people into a motel or, you know, they can't do much about that. And sometimes when we can't do something to prevent ourselves from feeling guilty about it, we go the opposite route and we kind of actually push them away.
Right.
And so a lot of our folks, when they go down there, sometimes they get, it's just sort of a, they just shut down. I don't know how else to explain it. Some of the providers, they just shut down and they don't go above and beyond. They don't go out of their way. They don't even go in their way. You know, sometimes it's just the very basic or even less. And that's because they know that some of what the person needs to do can't be done, or maybe they think that they are choosing not to do it. I don't know. So they don't give it the same care and attention. And I'm not saying like they're discriminating and it's blatant. They're discriminating because they don't like our folks. I just mean they maybe just don't have the capability to understand how to deal with it. I don't know, Michelle, you've had some actual in the emergency room experiences with people, and I don't know if you maybe want to share some of the things that are said. And not, I know it's, we're not trying to pick on anyone, but you know, there's just sometimes misinformation or misunderstanding.
Well, one instance was I took somebody in that was having a diabetic episode, and you know, we went in there, and right off the bat, you know, the doctor seemed almost angry at the person, and so the person shut down, like Diana was saying, you know, and they were like, okay, you know, and they started to get up off the gurney and leave. And I talked them into sitting back down because they had a very high blood sugar and it was dangerous. So I stepped out. I asked the doctor if I could talk to him. I stepped out, you know, and I said, you know, this person is homeless and they need care. Can you just please, you know, drop the attitude and do what you're supposed to do and give them care? And they said, okay, I'll do the basics of what I need to do. And come to find out, you know, what she was angry about was ended up being the hospital's fault and not his. Mm-hmm. So
frustrating,
you know,
frustrating.
It is frustrating.
Exactly. So Michael ended up where did Michael end up? What's the happy ending to the story?
He ended up in an adult foster home in Medford with some very lovely people who seem to be very loving and kind. He has a TV in his room that he's enjoying.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
He's clean and happy and warm.
He's just like the rest of us now. He gets to be just like the rest of us, and he gets to be treated like the rest of us, you know.
Like a normal human being.
Yeah,
with
how
worth.
We should all be.
Yes,
yeah.
A
they
human
take him
being
to the
with
doctor,
worth.
And they give him a haircut, and they are
that's
not afraid
great.
To touch him or afraid to help him, and and he gets what he deserves, you know?
That's just wonderful. And how many months did you put in to have that happen, Michelle?
Well, like I said, he didn't agree to go somewhere until a couple months ago, but it was a hard couple months with, you know, a lot
probably,
of work.
And stuff kept falling apart and, like, you know.
It was probably a good 9 months of Michelle interacting with him to get to that level. And
earn trust. And
before that, I had interacted with him for months. And so, and Bernie, of course, was, you know, very close with him. And so it really took a while for him to kind of warm up to me and then eventually warm up to Michelle and then eventually get to the point where Michelle and him were working on things.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, because there has to be a trust, right? If there's no no trust, then
or at least, like, once you get to know a person, you can kind of understand how to talk to them in a way that it takes us a minute sometimes, but we can understand how to talk to that individual person in a way that helps them be receptive to the information so that we're not re-traumatizing them by talking to them the way somebody else, you know, does that doesn't help them.
Right. Well, I'm thrilled. You know, I'm thrilled that there was a good ending to Michael. I'm really, you know, we were all kind of, you know, we were biting our nails on this one. So,
yeah,
you know,
we were.
Yeah. So, you may have noticed that we are out of time again. I know the little sign has been coming
I
up.
That.
You haven't seen it. I've seen it. I do want to applaud and thank you both for the work that you do, and especially for the heart that you bring to it. I thank you for your courage and your willingness to keep wading into those scenarios, knowing how difficult, frustrating, and emotionally draining the work is. I thank you for being willing to endure the many losses, and we'll celebrate the wins with you. So thank you. And thank you for listening. Our problems, our difficulties, lack of affordable housing, COVID, it does sometimes feel like we just can't catch a break. Just remember to celebrate those wins when they happen, because they do. Sometimes they're big, like with Michael Brown. Sometimes it's just getting your printer to work or finding the lost remote. Celebrate each one, always, and celebrate each other. This is Candace Michelle for our community. See you next week.